The White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20500. Governor Romney and President Obama, it is 3 days before the election, and none of the polls will tell me which one of you will win the election and take office next term, so I am sending this letter to both of you. I write for a few reasons. First, to thank you. You have both given up a great deal endeavoring to serve this nation whose ideals and vision, indeed its very foundation and principles, feel both precious and precarious to many. The U.S. faces an immense challenge where the enlightened principles upon which we were founded and our commitment to uphold them today are being questioned abroad and criticized at home. You have both campaigned with extraordinary determination, so I know you have witnessed the disillusionment and the distrust, the divisiveness and the anger that abounds. We are both desperate for and distrustful of good leadership. Just to step into the breach of such atmosphere requires courage, and I commend you both for that. I do not want to talk to you about specific policy, though, although like every other citizen, I hold my preferences. And anyone who has ever shared a beer with me or watched the news with me, or heaven help them both at the same time, knows I can have very strong opinions. Despite my earnest efforts to stay informed, though, it would be too easy to identify countless others far more qualified to advise you on policy matters. Instead, as a simple pastor, I want to weigh in on a few matters which have concerned me greatly while watching you, specifically watching you campaign and watching the country respond. These are matters in which I do have some experience and training and credibility. But before I get into that, I'd like to beg your indulgence for a moment while I do something important, which is to apologize to my congregation. The congregation which I currently serve has done amazing things. It has come to represent a beacon of hope and promise to the people of Manassas and Prince William County in Virginia, who are served by our food pantry, our work with shelters, and our role alongside other communities of faith to bring relief to mortgage foreclosure crisis devastating this country. But the congregation has also become a beacon in the hearts of so many who have been hungry to believe that there was one roof under which all people of different ages and races and classes and beliefs could come together and feel at home working for the common good. The people here have come to understand what a difference they can make and how hard work need not be drudgery, but filled with lots of laughter and meaning. Our time together has revealed an incomparable joy in our successes and great solace in our losses. Over many years, we have cultivated a love and loyalty to one another which has had us grow in spirit as well as in numbers. But this congregation is in the midst of great turning. A pastor served here for 8 years with unparalleled determination, and she and the congregation prospered. Now she has moved on, and there is grief, and there is concern about what is next. I have followed her, and in the first 3 months, I realized that I need to apologize, first and foremost, for not being her. I've come to understand that so many of the systems that are currently in place revolved around her and the trust and the confidence that people gave her to make everything work. In my short time here, I have joined the ranks of the many who wish she would come back. But that is not possible, and I am sorry. The congregation has had to cope with change internally about how we do things, which affects some of the beloved rituals and processes which gave us great comfort. And we are just beginning to explore the sea of change around us that may up the ante of what churches are expected to do to meet the growing needs of the larger community around them. This is hard work, and it requires some thought, some effort, and some sacrifice. At the very moment where what we would ask for most is comfort and reassurance. For this too, I am sorry. And because it has come to matter so much to us, some of this change has brought about disagreement and even conflict at a time when trust and cooperation are essential. I do not have any answers to avoid this, and I am sorry for that. What I do have is an incredible faith in the spirit of these people and the unprecedented potential that we possess to work together to meet whatever challenges are before us. But for the times where I lead with what is lacking instead of an immense admiration and appreciation of who we are and what we have to work with, and for failing to convey what a privilege it has been to be chosen to lead this congregation at such an important time, I am sorry. I apologize, gentlemen, because as you well know, it is tremendously important that if leadership is to remain strong, it cobbles its strength from the trust of its people. Leadership is supported and strengthened not as long as leaders are always right, but as long as leaders are always trusted. Without the people's trust in us, our ability to lead them, even if we hold on to our office, is essentially gone. Without our trust in the people, then our leadership and the democracy it upholds, even if it continues in place, does not work. Gentlemen, we are all leaders. Granted, there is a difference in the order of magnitude of our leadership. Pointing out that we are all leaders is like pointing out that 4 years ago, the family I strive to lead bought a car, and 4 years ago, the government that you strive to lead bought General Motors. But there is one thing common to all leaders, and that is the choice of how to lead. The best leaders throughout history are the ones who inspire. The worst leaders are those who lead through control. There is a choice that all leaders need to make, to compel the people using trust and democracy, or to control people using fear and manipulation. Which brings me to the points that I'd like to raise. During each of your campaigns, I have heard you both invoke God's blessing for your campaign and for your country. God bless you and God bless the United States of America, you have said. As a minister, my ears perk up every time a politician invokes and claims God's blessing. You'd be surprised how often I hear people invoke God's blessing who, in my opinion, have clearly not considered what God's blessing might require of them. The God that I pray to is a unifying God whose love extends to everyone and whose wish is for all people to unify toward the common good, not rally around a particular set of privileges. Too many times I have seen politicians invoke God's blessing as though it is a holy endorsement. It attempts to convince people that there is unity in the community when it is really a calculated maneuver toward a complicity of duplicity. I say this partly because I have heard both of you claim God's blessing in the very same breath as the claim that we are, quote, citizens of the greatest nation on the face of the earth. As an aside, I would like to state my opinion that this is a dubious claim. And although I am fiercely loyal to the principles on which we stand and our potential to offer what the world needs of us, I notice that we are ranked 7th by the World Economic Forum as places to live for good politics and economy, including a ranking of 54th in trust of our politicians. The World Health Organization ranked us 37th in the ability to provide health care to our citizens, including 49th in life expectancy and 178th in infant mortality. Harvard University's Program on Education Policy and Governance found that American students ranked 25th in math, 17th in science, 14th in reading among 34 industrialized nations. And in the category of freedom, which many believe is what our country stands for most, we do have the dubious honor of placing first in the highest percentage of its citizens living in incarceration. It feels like the claim that we are the greatest nation on earth is made out of pure hubris and pride. And that is what bothers me most. The quality that I liken the most with an enlightened spiritual being, someone most deserving of God's blessing, is the quality of humility. What ends up being called forth by claiming we are the greatest nation on earth is not unity so much as pride. And it is a false pride at that. For it unintentionally suggests dominance over less great nations. This not only promotes wariness and distrust among the globe's foreign citizenry, but it promotes arrogance and belligerence among our domestic citizenry. I know of no God worth praying to that would bless such thinking. And I believe that the attitude that we have put forth is caustic and contagious. And the worst part about it is that it has taken roots in the attitudes of the economic elite in this country. The super rich of this country, who do believe and justify a fundamental disparity among citizens, have steadily worked toward expecting more from and paying less into the infrastructure of this nation. They fund lobbies which control our legislation. They own the media and have lowered the standards of journalism, often to the rank of propaganda. And because of Citizens United, they assume enormous power over the election process with little or no accountability. And the vast majority of the power and influence they have, they maintain by propagating messages of fear and hate and division. Gentlemen, I know you are familiar with this because both your campaigns are absorbed, if not submerged, in this mentality. It is the mentality that has led us into military wars abroad, often as veiled efforts to protect corporate interests, and ideology wars at home. Political strategists will convince you with their charts and graphs and statistics that the rhetoric of fear and hate is effective at motivating people and winning voters over to your side. The problem is that your opponent also uses that same strategy to win them back to his side. And when both of you use this same strategy of fear, the citizenry of the nation is palsied between two bad choices: either become fearful and often belligerent, or become disillusioned, apathetic, and uninvolved. Caustic amounts of fear polarize people. That is why I advocate in congregations as well as in countries leadership that comes about by building trust rather than leadership that comes by building fear. Over the course of my life, I have come to understand that unmanaged fear is always a precursor to war. And though we all profess to be against war, there is a reason why people allow fear to often lead them. Lawrence Lashawn, in his book, The Psychology of War, explains. He says, "War sharpens our experience. It heightens our perception and makes us more and more aware of our existence. At the same time, war allows us to become part of something larger and more intense." End quote. This may be true, that war gives us an added sense of intensifying our life. And it brings people together and gets them to sharpen their attention. It may be true for a while. I recall the words of writer Joe Cordert, who lived in England during the German invasion during World War II, and when asked by a reporter how it felt when the bombings finally stopped, she surprisingly spoke of disappointment. "Oh," she said, "it was a marvelous time during the bombings. You forgot about yourself and you did what you could and we were all in it together. It was frightening, of course, and you worried about getting killed, but in some ways it was better than now. Now we are all just ourselves again." The problem with war is that for it to meet the needs of the people, it has to do two things simultaneously: to stop resolutely and immediately, and to continue forever. And so even as we end one war, we are always finding ourselves on the lookout for the next one. That is what leadership by fear is all about. I understand the intense singularity and solidarity of purpose that soldiers talk about in wartime. As a civilian, I've known moments of deep conviction with others around war, the sense of compassion, of charity, of pride, and in our collective values. But in the long run, as a minister, I believe that war's ability to offer humanity the promise of peace and cooperation is just a myth. Listen to these words from writer Troy Chapman, who describes my thoughts. He writes, "War has lied to us. It told us it would make the world a better place, increase goodness, reduce evil. So we said, yes, let's wage war. We have said this so often, it has become part of who we are. Yes to war on crime. Yes to war on drugs. Yes to war on poverty. Yes to war on communism and terrorism. Yes to whatever we think is evil. War promised to win, to stamp out evil. But war has become the evil it had set out to kill. We assume that if we kill enough evil, goodness will simply rise up spontaneously. This is a deadly error. Goodness isn't just what happens when evil is eradicated. Goodness is something that must be cultivated and planted and tended and grown like growing wheat. But we've left the fields and gone off to war. War by itself is an attempt to control. But we can't make life or people do what we want. All we can do is influence, and the best way to influence a world toward goodness is by showing it care and love. We want goodness without the bother of having to love people. That's the mistaken premise of war, that we can make people be good without loving them." End quote. Fear and war are no substitutes for care and love. There is a story of a minister who took his daughter to the zoo and stood amazed before one particular cage with a big sign over the bars labeled "Coexistence." And looking inside, the minister noticed a lion laying down with some lambs. And the minister stood dumbstruck. It was a miracle. It had to be the second coming, the revelation foretold in the Bible. And the minister quickly sought out the zookeeper and wanted to know what he had done to bring about such divine circumstance. "There's really nothing miraculous about it," the zookeeper explained. "We just have to add a few fresh lambs now and then." So I ask you, gentlemen, does coexistence always mean sacrifice of the most vulnerable? And if so, how do you invoke God's blessing for such a strategy? Perhaps the answer is in this poem by Andrea Evazian, who is minister of the Haydenville Congregation in Massachusetts. This poem is called "Before the Destruction Begins." "Before you confer with men pale and tired, who have forgotten that deep goodness is shy and tender, and does not lurk in the dark rooms where you gather, and does not make plans that will cause mothers to bury their children and does not create suffering. Before you study the map with X's and circles, the map that shows cities and airfields, ports and factories, but does not show faces, omits the stories told by the grandfather awaiting his grandson after school, the woman laboring in the hospital with clean white sheets, but little else. Before you hear the choices that involve how many and how much and how wide and how long and how awful, and you weigh the options coolly without sobbing or repenting or getting on your knees. Before you nod and say yes, before you approve the strikes with drones that will destroy towns that you have not visited, kill people you have not met, ruin homes with gardens, crush buildings with people, classrooms with students inside, before, take both your hands and lay them on a baby's head. Close your eyes and listen deeply to the waves breaking on a distant shore. Hear the noise of a busy marketplace. Smell the freshness of the air when there is no fear. Gentlemen, I don't think that God gives you her blessing, at least not with respect to your politics of fear. The God that I know wants there to be less of it, to make the elimination of fear our individual and collective purpose, from which we derive a sense of unity with all people of all nations. And the God I know will not take sides, will not side with them nor with us, will not call one side evil and the other side chosen, will not favor the glory of one people or the glory of one nation. The God I know only understands the glory of life. Sincerely, Reverend Greg Ward, Manassas, Virginia.